Welcome back to this weekly meeting of the Community Planning and Housing Committee with Denver City Council. Your Community Planning and Housing Committee starts now.
All right. Pausing about that. Okay. Great, thank you, Tim. So this is the Community Planning and Housing Committee of Denver City Council. We will have, I think, one presentation today and no action items, which we're excited about and have been planning for a while. I am the committee chair and council member at large, Sarah Parity, and I will start with introductions of other council members, starting online, I think.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Amanda Sandoval, Northwest Denver, District 1. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay.
Thanks, Council President. Councilman Torres.
Thank you. Jamie Torres, West Denver District 3. Hi, folks.
All right. And hopefully other folks trickle in a little bit. I will let DHA introduce all of yourselves and take it away. We're excited.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us today here at the Community Planning and Housing Committee. This is a pleasure for us having this opportunity to talk a little bit about the housing choice budget programs that we're managing. My name is Joaquin Cintron Vega. I am the Chief Executive Officer at Denver Housing Authority.
Hello, and thank you as well. My name is Loretta Owens. I'm the Housing Choice Voucher Program Director.
Good afternoon. Joshua Crowley, Chief Operating Officer and General Counsel.
Good afternoon. Stephanie Sheeman, the Director of Communications and Public Affairs at the Denver Housing Authority.
Great. Thanks for bringing such a strong team today.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So we want to keep the presentation brief because we believe that it is very important to having a conversation with you about this specific topic. So today we aim to provide perspective about the programs and the crucial challenge, of course, that we are facing today, as you know. And very important for us is to provide perspective not only to the committee, but also to those members of the community that may not be familiar with our programs and want to know more or to get a better understanding of how they work and operate, including, of course, the number of resources that we are managing. So for us, that is very important, acknowledging the individuals that may be having access to this broadcast. So again, we will keep this presentation very brief to allow for a good conversation in the end with you and to answer any questions that you may have. Josh?
Thank you. All right, I'm going to give you guys a little bit of background on the Housing Choice Voucher Program and DHA specifically. So I'm going to start with, we are referring to the Housing Choice Voucher Program, which you might have heard referred to previously as the Section 8 program. So several years ago, HUD changed the nomenclature. So Section 8, HCV, same program. HCV is the current name of the program. Housing Choice Voucher, public housing, are two different things. DHA manages both. So we have our Housing Choice Voucher program, which is what we're here to talk to you about today. We also have our public housing program, which are the properties that DHA actually owns and manages within the city. Two different programs funded through different sources through HUD. And then the last distinction that I want to make is within the HCV program, and by the way, we're going to throw a ton of acronyms at you today, so if any of them, if you're not familiar with any of them, please ask. Tenant-based vouchers versus project-based vouchers. Those are two different kinds of vouchers that we administer within the Housing Choice Voucher Program. A tenant-based voucher is given to a participant. They go out into the market, they find a unit that a housing provider is willing to rent to them, and they sign a lease with that housing provider. Project-based vouchers, we are allowed to take a certain percentage of our vouchers and project-base them. So rather than being tied to the participant who is out in the market, as with a tenant-based voucher, a project-based voucher we actually take and we put that on a unit, and so that assistance is now tied to a unit, and individuals can come and go from that unit, but the assistance stays there. Okay. The HCB program is really impactful for our participants and reducing housing instability and in our community at large. And I'm going to talk a little bit about those things. So the first thing is that the HCB program expands access to safe and affordable housing. And you're going to hear me say a lot today, participant choice. So the HCB program provides participant choice for safe and affordable housing options for our folks. It stabilizes families and reduces homelessness. We also support the local housing market. Specifically, most of our housing providers are what we refer to as mom and pops. They have one, two, a handful of units. They're not big corporate landlords that own entire apartment buildings. We have some of that, but the vast majority of our housing providers own five or fewer units. And so really the Housing Choice Voucher Program is an economic engine in the community for those housing providers. We also, Housing Choice Voucher also promotes economic opportunity and mobility. Again, participant choice. If they're not happy in their current unit, after the end of their lease, they can move somewhere else if they choose to do that. And finally, HCV allows us to leverage federal investment for local impact. And for example, this year, DHA is budgeted to spend $142 million in housing assistance payments in the community with our housing providers. So that is an enormous financial impact that the HCV program is having right here in the Denver community. We are administering a little under 8,600 vouchers of various types, and Loretta is going to talk a little bit about what those different types of vouchers that we have are. We are assisting over 19,000 very low and moderate income individuals in the city. Again, we talked about participant choice, geographic choice. Individuals have the opportunity to take their voucher anywhere they want within the city and county of Denver, and in some circumstances outside the city and county of Denver. We talked about preventing homelessness and housing instability with the rents and the rent burdens that we know are prevalent in the Denver area right now. This prevents evictions, it prevents shelter entry. And then the last piece is that DHA has a huge commitment to this program. In 2025, we have a budgeted HCV department of over 70 dedicated employees just to the HCV program. So that shows the commitment that those federal dollars and the DHA is making to the HCV program. Loretta?
So just in general, as Josh mentioned, we're serving almost 8,600 individuals, and that's families within the community with our Housing Choice Voucher. One thing to note that the Housing Choice Voucher program in and of itself is the umbrella of the 8,600. Of that, we are allowed to project base up to 30% of those vouchers. So this is not a separate set of vouchers associated with project basing. It is us project basing a percentage of the tenant-based vouchers. We also have what I like to call and refer to as boutique vouchers, and those are special program vouchers that serve special populations like our veterans, our non-elderly but disabled families, and our non-elderly disabled individuals as well. We also have vouchers that provide subsidy to our foster youth families. So those are individuals between the ages of 18 and 24 that are exiting the foster care program, and also families that are exiting the foster care programs. And of course, our veterans, our VASH vouchers as well. So there's little boutique, what I like to call special programs that we administer. Of that, there's about 1,000 or so boutique vouchers that are associated with those programs. Again, those are vouchers that are inside of the tenant-based program. We do have some vouchers that are outside of that umbrella, such as you may have heard of the emergency housing assistant vouchers, which are going away as the program comes to an end here next year. But yeah, so that's it pretty much for the vouchers. I want to talk a little bit about the payment standards. And so when we're talking about payment standards, Josh mentioned earlier about affordability in the community. The vouchers and the payment standards associated with those vouchers allow us to determine affordability. So the fair market rent is set by HUD. And what PHAs are allowed to do is to set their voucher payment standards anywhere between 90 to 110% of the FMRs. You are allowed to go up to 120% of the FMRs if you're operating under a waiver or under special permission through HUD. The HCV program was operating last year at 120% of the FMR, which so our payment standards were set at that 120% level. However, we have since reduced that to 100% of the fair market rent. So right now our payment standards are set at 100%. And when we make that decision, we look at current rents, what housing providers are currently asking in our program and what the rents are going for in the area, as well as our budget authority to set it based off what, you know, is happening with the budget at that point in time. And now we will talk about income limits. So a lot of times individuals and the public hear about talk about income limits. Income limits is the income limit that families are assessed with at the time to determine qualification of the program. So we're looking at what the families can afford based off of, or the families entering into the program based off of the area median income. And so the area median income is what we're also referring to as income limits here, and you have them here on the screen, is also in your packets. And then we also set, once they're on the program, the families are set at 30 to 40% of their income when they're out searching for a unit to make sure that they maintain affordability.
So while having this conversation, we believe that is very important to, you know, discuss this within the context of affordability and what that means. In a way, again, you know, in consideration of those individuals, including council members and members of the committee, but members of our community, so they can truly understand not only the opportunity that we have about managing these programs and resources, but the challenge that we're facing. And so we, as one community, how can we find solutions to that housing crisis? So when we're talking about a housing crisis, I believe that is also very important defining what that means from the context of the individuals that are either or participating through the programs or looking forward to getting that housing stability opportunity. So I have a very personal definition about what a housing crisis means. And in my opinion, a housing crisis should be defined by the challenging conditions that families, individuals, they are facing, and therefore any solution to that crisis should be focused on improving those conditions. So we're talking about social determinants of health and things like that that may affect those families that are working or getting their ways to achieving whatever is necessary to get that end goal of affordable housing. So I want to start by showcasing our 2026 minimum wage for Denver, which is going to increase from $18.81 to $19.29 an hour again in 2026, effective January 1st. On paper, that sounds like progress. Of course, we are increasing that minimum wage, but it's not really progress in the sense of, is that enough for families and individuals to get access to affordable housing, right? So it is not enough from the context of meeting the rising cost of living that we are facing here, specifically that segment of the population. So this figure represents the hardworking residents of our city. And those are the people that are serving food, cleaning buildings, caring for our children and elderly. And yet, even working full time at this wage, they are being priced out of the very communities that they serve. And across the nation, as you know, 30% of income is the benchmark for affordable housing. Spend more than that, and families, then they must choose between rent and childcare or food. But in Denver, far too many are spending currently 40, 50, even 60% of their income just to keep a roof overhead. And that is the reality that we're facing. So the result, of course, is that families are falling behind, savings vanish, and stability disappears for those families. At Denver's minimum wage, a full-time worker can afford roughly $1,003 a month for rent before they are considered cost-burdened. But we need to be mindful, and let's be clear, $1,003 doesn't get any given family a decent one-bedroom apartment anywhere near the city's core. So what this means is for working families that they are being pushed farther from opportunity, away from schools, transit, and jobs, while their commute, which is an additional consideration, is also an element that is rising their cost of living. As you know, the average full-time worker puts in about 173 hours a month, 40 hours a week, every week. And they show up. I mean, those families, those individuals, they truly show up. They put in the work that is necessary. But despite their commitment, those hours no longer guarantee stability. And it is not, again, it is not a lack of effort. It is a mismatch between wages and rent. And today, the fair market rent for a two-bedroom home in Denver is $2,089 a month. That is what the fair market for a two-bedroom apartment currently is, and that is the price tag, basically, if we want to get into a somehow, aspirational goal, that is the price tag of the American dream in our city, $2,089. And it is slipping out of the reach for too many families right now. For families, teachers, nurses, and service workers, this definitely marks the difference between stability and displacement. So to afford a two-bedroom home in Denver, a worker earning minimum wage must put in nearly 361 hours every month. That is more hours than physically possible in a single job, and that is the reality. It is the reality of people that is or are juggling multiple shifts, missing time with their children, which is even perhaps more important, and fighting exhaustion just to keep up, just to achieve something that some of us, we are taking for granted, right? So to rent a two-bedroom home within this context, in Denver today, any given family or head of household will need 2.08 full-time jobs. And let's think about that. That means that a person will need to work more than 80 hours per week. And still, if they achieve those 80 hours, they still will fall short. So that's a huge element of consideration here. And again, this is not a personal failure. I see that, we see that at DHA as a failure that relates to policy failure, right? And the math is clear. And more than that, I think that the mandate is urgent. We must close the gap between wages and rent so that one job and only one job is enough. So this additional slide is basically telling the story of Denver in one snapshot. Our minimum wage, $19.29, is standing in stark contrast to the $40.17 hourly wage that it takes to afford a modest home here in Denver. A family should not need to work 360 hours a month or juggle two full-time jobs just to stay housed. And then again, we are seeing a whole bunch of numbers, but this is not just math. I believe that in the end, it becomes a moral equation, right? How can we build the necessary conditions for a group, some, many, most, preferably everybody can truly afford a place to call home here in Denver. But then again, I believe that we have the power to change that. And again, by investing in affordable housing, housing affordability, to, you know, stabilize budgets, and in doing that, stabilizing the lives of those that we so proudly serve. So in connection to that story, and then again, I went through those numbers just to provide some context about not only what we are managing, but what this truly means in the practice and the challenges that we're facing, right? As of today, the federal government remains in a partial shutdown, with key negotiations in Congress still on an impasse over spending priorities. And while essential services, they continue, many housing and community development programs are facing delays. I feel appropriate to say, and this is our commitment, that Denver Housing Authority is closely and will continue to closely monitor the situation to ensure continuity of our operations and, of course, the protection of the resident services that we provide. And our message is clear. Stability for families cannot wait on politics. And I will repeat that. Stability for families cannot wait on politics. So we will stay proactive, transparent, and ready to respond as soon as a resolution is reached, of course. Also, to provide additional perspective over the past 7 years and perspective about the commitment and the great work that those that are in this room, but most importantly, those that came before us, the work that they have been doing to, you know, maintaining afloat the programs and serving as many families as possible. So over the past 7 years, DHA's average yearly per unit cost has surged beyond $1,400. And yet, DHA provides housing stability for as many residents as our resources allow. And this is important because I believe that this is a testament, this is evidence about the disciplined stewardship, operational efficiency, and the ability that DHA has employed over the many years and decades to maximize every federal dollar, even though we are behaving and living within an environment that is hugely over-regulated and very well underfunded. That is the reality of many housing authorities across the board and across the nation. So looking forward, and I think that the key takeaway here is that the housing choice voucher strategy that we have at DHA is one that is laser focused. We are aiming, looking forward to maximize the utilization through a data-driven management approach What that means is that we are intentional about ensuring that the populations that we are serving and those programs that Loretta were describing prior are mirroring the different segments of our population, and that we have in place those programs that are going to ensure a streamlined process so we can be more effective and more efficient in providing the services that we provide, meaning housing stability opportunities through the voucher programs. We are considering and putting in place action steps to strengthen our administrative efficiency with greater utilization and maximization of those resources. We can maximize then the administrative fees that we are getting, and on that same consideration, of course, streamlining the processes that we have in place. So that's one key consideration for DHA. We are aiming to deepen landlord partnerships and diversifying the resources that we are managing and we have in place, and how can we collectively, at the very beginning of my remarks, I was making reference about this being basically a challenge, but also an opportunity that DHA will need to undertake with community partners to be successful. So we are aiming to establishing memorandum of understandings, creating these special voucher programs that we are talking about to streamline the housing stability for those specific populations, specifically those that may be facing more than housing stability, some social determinants of health that are preventing them to get to those opportunities. And of course, you know, to integrate our voucher programs with redevelopment activity, a policy pipeline strategy in which we can maximize those project-based vouchers. I want to recognize the presence of Eric Clark here in the audience, our chief of real estate investment. So we are working in collaboration with Eric, the voucher programs, Josh, Loretta, to develop what we're calling a rolling RFP, which is going to provide not only a better sense of awareness of the resources that we're managing at any given point in time, specifically relating to the project-based vouchers, but what is going to be the process that those developers will need to follow, so in the end that they can get a conditional commitment from DHA, and after the successful completion of those on those commitments, a process for us to formalize the commitment so they can utilize those resources as part of the different deals and projects that they are managing. So in closing, I wanted to say that the work of DHA as it pertains to housing stability, rental assistance, the voucher programs, is not starting and ending there. We also leverage some additional supports, specifically from our nonprofit affiliates, to do as much as we can, not only providing housing stability, but addressing those social determinants of health. And I want to mention the work that is being done by friends of DHA, a nonprofit affiliate of the Denver Housing Authority, providing supports on community building, digital inclusion, healthy living, and very related to this topic, economic and self-sufficiency, which is important, and our focus on the youth through the Youth Employment Academy and the different opportunities that we have for our people through our social enterprises. And as you know, we have the Cater Fresh in the Sun Valley community. We have the Osage Cafe there in the same building in which we have our central offices in the Mariposa neighborhood. We offer internships, industry academies, well-being, and mentoring. So we are implementing a holistic approach, not only managing those resources for housing stability, but walking the extra mile in partnership with other community partners to ensure that we are not only achieving just that with the limited resources that we have in place, but how can we take those families, individuals out of the challenges that they're facing, that they are facing in consideration of those social determinants of health. So I will stop here. And we welcome any questions that you may have, and very much looking forward to a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is exactly what we're hoping to get out today, and I don't think I was super clear in the request, so you just read our minds. I'd like to welcome Council President Pro Tem Romero Campbell to the meeting. Thank you. And yeah, the queue so far, it starts with Councilmember Torres.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all. Really appreciate the information. What is HUD, when they determine the fair market rent, what's their region? Is it just Denver? Is it a metro region? Is it the state?
Go ahead. It's a metro region and includes the Denver metro area, Centennial, Aurora. It's a larger region that is within the consideration of the same market, fair market rents that are applicable to us. They are applicable to that extended area.
Okay. You said, I wanted to make sure I heard right, the emergency voucher program is coming to an end next year. What does that mean?
Yeah, so HUD implemented many years ago this emergency housing voucher program. That program was intended to serve individuals facing homelessness, chronic homelessness, sex, dating violence, and other categories. So HUD has already informed that that program is sunsetting next year, September 30th of next year. So what that means in the practice is for all program participants that we have in place as of now or any given date in the future, if we, for whatever reason, there is a move out from the program, a program participation ending, things like that, DHA, and this is applicable to all housing authorities, we cannot issue again those
emergency vouchers.
We,
how do you get them back though? Like how do you, like somebody can continue using it?
Those are the solutions that we are exploring right now. So for example, and Loretta can perhaps talk a little bit more about it. What we have been doing is twofold. We are leveraging one additional program, which is the non-elderly disabled program that is not affected with this level of constraints that we are facing right now. So we are leveraging that program, number one. Number two, we are getting, and this is information that was made available through a notice that was published by HUD. Eventually, we can leverage the main program, the Housing Choice Voucher programs, to ensure that those families in the end that we will have, we can then transition them to the main program that we have in place.
Okay. Anything additional on that, Loretta?
Right, and so one thing to mention is that we started out with 190 of those EHV vouchers. Today, we're at about 121 of those vouchers. So families have been placed within the NED program, as Joaquin mentioned, or they've moved on to other affordable housing types.
Will there come a point where HUD just yanks them? And
the funding will run out.
It will.
Right, yeah. So September 30th is when the program ends.
Okay.
But the funding itself is anticipated to run out by June of next year. So our plan, like Joaquin mentioned, is to transition the remaining of those families into tenant-based vouchers before that happens.
Okay. The additional slides that are kind of in an appendix on this, they don't add up to the same number of... Oh, maybe they do. 85, 88, that's all of those other categories combined,
is
what I'm assuming.
Yes.
Okay. So when the mayor's office said that they lost 100 vouchers from Denver Housing Authority, were those vouchers that we're talking about in the emergency voucher category, or what did that mean?
So a couple of years ago, there was a commitment to the city to provide 300 vouchers on increments of 100 vouchers per year. So this will be the second year of that commitment. As you know, Denver Housing Authority, as well as many other housing authorities across the nation, we got in a level of restriction that was imposed by HUD to manage the described shortfall in funding available to support the housing programs, right? The specific housing choice budget program. One of the mandates that was imposed to DHA and other housing authorities with same circumstances is that we could not issue any additional vouchers, but we could maintain the housing stability for all program participants that we may have at any given point in time today or moving forward out of that consideration. Because of that, we could not issue any additional vouchers outside of those that we are managing. The 100 vouchers initially allocated are coming from that pool of tenant-based vouchers. And because of that, that level of assistance, or not assistance, but the allocation of those additional vouchers to the city were impossible to fulfill because of that restriction that was imposed to HUD. What is important to explain, and thank you for the question, is that now the action steps that DHA is implementing in agreement with the action plan that was agreed upon with HUD, in which we are, in one hand, reducing the level of funding that we are utilizing on a monthly basis from the budget authority so we can level up that funding. Authority is going to open for us an opportunity in 2026 because the baseline for us is going, utilization of those resources will be below the baseline of what the budget authority is, meaning that we can and we will have the necessary caution to come back and replenish those vouchers at that point in time.
When is that?
Effective 2026.
Okay.
So that, of course, that is contingent to the significant level of progress that we are making and we will continue to achieve. But then again, we need to be fiscally responsible about that and making sure that all the elements of consideration are in place so we can then be assertive at the moment in time in which we are going to be allocating those vouchers.
Okay, so right now there's 200 that are in play with the city, but it'll ramp back up again to the normal numbers in 26.
And important to clarify, this is not a recurrent, it's not an allocation that will reset every single year.
Yeah.
We are managing one budget authority that fluctuates depending on many factors, utilization, a look back period that HUD is using to determine what they are going to be providing to us and how that is going to play a role in the congressional appropriation process. So it's a commitment of 300 vouchers.
Mm-hmm.
Not a commitment to refill those 300 over time and time again.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
One of the things that I'm thinking about in terms of the new housing that you're building, how then do you apply? Do you apply kind of your voucher allocation to your new housing, like in Sun Valley? Or in Mariposa, or is that maintained elsewhere throughout your sites? And do you anticipate getting any additional voucher allowance or kind of clearance from HUD?
Do you want to talk about the AHAP and HAP process?
Yes. And so with that, not all of our new builds include project-based vouchers, okay, or, you know, tenant-based voucher holders can lease those units if they so choose, right? We talked about choice earlier, but it is not associated with that process. And so the AHAP process that Joaquin is referring to is when you enter into an agreement to enter into a HAP contract under that long-term affordability project-based process. And then when you enter into a HAP contract with the owners or the developers, then you enter into the agreement to start the leasing process for those long-term projects. But I think more to your point is that it's not necessarily tied to the voucher program, yeah, in and of itself. It is separate. So we do have our housing management department that Josh mentioned earlier that's managing those non-project-based or units as well. So they're leasing through tax credits and other affordable means.
Okay. Are you finding that people are coming back to DHA with their tenant-based voucher just because rents are just higher in general neighborhoods than they are on your property sites?
It's public housing.
Do you want to provide perspective of the wait list? And
sure. Yes, we do. We do find, so let's talk about Sun Valley as an example.
Yeah.
Typically, one-third market, one-third tax credit, one-third subsidized affordable. So in the tax credit and the market rate units, and when we talk about market rate, we hold our market under actual market. They're market for us, but they're not true market. Mm-hmm. We do find that those units, those two types of units, the tax credit and the market rate units, tend to be filled with folks using vouchers.
Okay.
And it's beneficial for them. It's better, easier for them to rent from us because our rents are lower and within the FMR that Loretta talked about and our payment standards. Because if somebody's trying to rent a unit that's above those, then the voucher doesn't work unless we negotiate with the landlord and they're willing to reduce the rent. So to your question, yes, we do find that we have a lot of folks bringing their vouchers and renting from us because of where we set our rents.
Okay. And any opportunity to grow for growth, and then I'll stop there, of the amount of vouchers that you're able to use?
Opportunity for growth. Yes, so we're always seeking opportunities to apply for additional vouchers from HUD. In fact, we have a request for additional HUD VASH vouchers with HUD right now,
okay,
in addition to 22 HUD VASH vouchers. So we're always looking for an opportunity to grow the voucher program by applying for additional vouchers from HUD.
And,
but right now, we're currently leasing at capacity.
So I want,
okay,
to also, considering that question, outside of these 22 that we are requesting, we most recently expressed or registered our interest in partnership with the Veteran Affairs Office. We, prior to that, this year early, we got an additional allocation of 25 Veteran Affairs vouchers. And important to also note is that when we, as a community, we come together and we not only express the need, but we can provide evidence to HUD about having that plan that makes sense, the necessary community partners aligned with that plan, and how the partnership in managing this additional level of resources that we are asking for, that is going to be effective through these partnerships and the need that we are expressing to HUD. That's something that we can and should be doing. Most recently, I believe it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago, don't quote me on the number of years, but what is important is that my predecessor, Ismael Guerrero, at the time, working with Dr. Rife, when she was leading MDHI and other community partners, they submitted a community supported request to HUD. And through those efforts, we received an allocation of additional vouchers through the NED, Non-Elderly Disabled Program, adding to the capacity that at that moment in time we had. So we can and should be doing the same in consideration of the existing challenges and the overwhelming level of support that we have within this community to do just that.
Okay. The other question I was going to ask is, we are seeing both eligibility requirements for SNAP come into place around like work requirements, mm-hmm. and I think deadlines or timelines for being on the benefit. Are you seeing those as well for your HUD benefit programs? And what is your strategy going to be if you do start losing mm-hmm. folks from your rules? Because my impression is that the intention behind adding all these rules to some of the other benefit programs is to thin out who's yeah. utilizing them because they just drop off the yeah. rules. So how is that going to affect the HUD programs?
Yeah, great question. Thank you for that. The 2026 budget, the budget that is within consideration, is not considering working requirements or term limits within the housing programs. Yes, other programs, SNAP, I mean, TANF and those, yes, are considering those elements, not directly the housing program, so we are not facing that challenge right now, but we do recognize that the application of those two things, or at least the working requirements on other programs, will have a compound effect that is going yeah. to, in the end, affect the people that we are serving through the housing stability opportunities. And then again, how those additional elements will impact them specifically and personally, and how the ability for them to afford a place to call home is going to be affected, right?
So sure.
we are aware of those conditions. And for me, that's why I wanted to mention the additional supports that we have in place through the Resident and Community Connection Program Department of DHA, but on top of that, the output from our nonprofit affiliates providing those additional supports that can help families and individuals mitigate those yeah. Adverse
I can imagine conditions. Even seeing like our November SNAP benefits, right, are not likely to come through. And for a family who typically might have received $100 a month for yeah. SNAP benefits, they don't have that anymore, but they needed that to buy groceries and have to fill it with something else. So totally see that kind of layered effect. Just the last thing.
Councilwoman, I wanted to also express, because I believe it's totally important to recognize the hard work by leaders within the Denver Housing Authority. We have been proactive ever since day one, and not only touching base at the congressional level, touching base with the U.S. Department of Housing at the local, regional, and national level. Our regional leadership came to visit us, and we talked specifically about these topics that you are making reference, and we provided them guidance through lived experiences. And the key takeaway in the end was, there is no way that you can implement something like this because it's not a one-size-fits-all. You cannot yeah. say 2 years and you're done. That is not how it works.
Yeah.
And we had an opportunity to express to them not only the work that we are doing, how we're doing the work, and what is the impact that we're creating. As a result, we hosted a contingent of about 27 national leaders from HUD that came to Denver, our Sun Valley community, and we visited Westridge, and we talk about many wonderful things about the work that we are doing in this community and how this can be used as a model to be replicated. And then again, we had an additional opportunity to provide very assertive guidance, I will say, to them about how things are done in Denver in terms of supporting families and individuals navigating through the programs and exiting those programs successfully namely a home ownership opportunity or any other avenue for economic advancement. And I think that the input that we have provided, I mean, DHA has provided, I will not say that because of this level of engagement and communication and interaction that we have had with HUD, the result in the end was not inserting these considerations as part of the budget for the housing related programs. But we, because we will let those conversations and we remain in conversation as well and collaboration with different advocacy groups, NARO, CLAFA, FARA, and many others. I think that that placed DHA on a different lens, and as well as a result of that, the whole ecosystem of housing authorities and those advocacy groups that are supporting our work. And I wanted to say that, just to say in the end that here in Denver, we are not here just to manage those programs. We are here also to understand the conditions of the people that we're serving. How can we make things better? And how can we leverage those partnerships that are important in the end so we can achieve just that?
Yeah, no. And I definitely see that as like the long-term opportunity. It's tough to pivot, right, when you have 2 weeks notice for some folks. Because I wonder about like your Decatur Fresh location, how much of the revenue that that market takes that are from EBT cards? Like it's one of the business plan items for what sustains a market in a housing authority neighborhood, in my eyes anyway. So it's the closest market in a few miles for Sun Valley residents. So thank you so much. And just to comment, a lot of the DHA family knows this about me, but Section 8 housing saved my family from homelessness, and it's one of the things that I always look to as a saving grace for mine and hundreds, if not thousands, of other families throughout the metro area for allowing folks to, one, find housing in a place that they need it to be. Probably much harder now than it was 30 years ago, but I just really appreciate the work and the heart that you put into it. So thank you so much.
Thank you for your support.
Well, I don't have Council President or Council Pro Tem in the queue so far. I'll pause for you guys, and I definitely have questions too. So, okay. Council President, raise your hand at any time or ping me. So I have a lot of questions. That's a great thing about being chair. You can bring in the people that you want to ask questions of. And I'm really appreciative of this because what you guys do in this, I mean, even just this subpart of DHA is so complex, and it helps us even having a better sense of what I don't know has helped me be a better council member in this area. So thank you. One of the questions overlaps with what Councilmember Torres was asking, which has to do with like voucher types over time and kind of these goofy HUD processes where you can apply for like a little bump or whatever. If you have a chart of the voucher types over time, that would be great. I would love to see that because that would help me orient myself a little bit as someone who doesn't have a lot of background in, you know, this. And then when you were talking about the other non-base vouchers, I take it that of those 235, would I be right that 120 of those about are the ones that are the VHV ones, where the funding is ending in June, and you're trying to get those folks into the regular base tenant vouchers. Okay.
Just for clarification, the emergency housing vouchers are falling within that consideration. The additional, which is the mainstream, what means is that they are living within a different budget authority than the greater pool of resources.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Okay. Thank you for that. And then could you talk a little bit more about what else falls under those other non-base vouchers? I take maybe there's just been federal programs from time to time, but what other clusters are in there that might run out of funding at a certain point?
Under the 235. Right. There's the two categories that Joaquin just mentioned.
Okay,
the EHV vouchers and the mainstream. Yes.
Okay, thank you. That's the whole 235. Thanks. And then I think the other thing that is... It's a big question, and it just comes from being like, you know, not having been on council for that long, being outside of this work for the most part. Could you guys like zoom back a little bit and tell us like what else is changing within the voucher program? So I've heard even just from tenants, honestly, about maybe like federal mandates to get paperwork in faster. You know, what else is changing if you are someone who is on an HCB voucher?
Yeah, and so when you say changing, that's, you know, that's kind of a big word, changing, right? And so right now what's happening is with the paperwork getting in faster is Joaquin mentioned that right now we're under guidance from HUD to maintain strict compliance. And so what that means is that we're asking our participants to watch those timelines and make sure that they're turning in the paperwork promptly to avoid termination from the program. Mm-hmm. Because termination from the program today may not mean that you'll automatically be reinstated just by complying after the fact.
Right, whereas there used to be maybe more generosity there.
Exactly.
Okay, but have there also been any substantive changes other than the, that sort of like a lesser level of flexibility, that's one thing. Have there been substantive changes from the federal level to paperwork people have to provide when they have to provide it, you know, anything like that?
Not necessarily from the federal level in that the program itself has changed.
Okay.
It's just the guidelines and what we're asking families to do during this time has okay. changed. Voucher timelines is limited to 60 days search time versus before in other days where you can go up to 180 days search time. So those are the things that are changing right now based off this current budget authority that we're operating.
Okay. That is super clarifying for me, just sort of like why that's happening in that way. I think we would all be really interested to see, you know, at some point down the line, if you start to get a sense of the rate of people who aren't able to find housing in that timeline because of the market being what it is, even, you know, even though this is supposed to be pinned to the market, I would love to know if you're starting to see more families who are in fact, I mean, I assume that's sort of the aim at the federal level.
Yeah,
I'll just say it,
definitely.
You know what I'm saying?
We can get you that information.
So we'd love to see those numbers so we can keep our eyes on it because, you know, I don't know if we can do anything about it, but it's the kind of thing we should know. So I'd be very appreciative of that. And then, I guess I should say, when did you have to start being more stringent exactly? Like when did that
happen? So April 17th.
April 17th, okay.
Yeah. Was the date that we met with HUD and they said, okay, you need to start.
You know the date.
Yeah, I know the date.
I didn't think you would. I thought you'd be like, yeah, it was spring. Yeah. So April 17th. All right.
Yes, yes. And so when we started to see the impact of that started to be, you know, you have to kind of roll things out, procedures and so on and so forth. So May 1st is when we really started to change our procedures, our payment standards and things like that to put
okay.
things in place.
Okay, so there may already be some data then. I would be super interested, and it can be a follow-up email, but if it's possible to tell us, even if it's not, if it's comparative and goes back in time, that's great, but if it's even just April to, you know, now, every month, how many people have been terminated for the reason that they couldn't find, you know, they didn't secure a lease within the time allowed, I would be really interested in that. Okay, and then the other thing, we didn't ask to cover necessarily, and it's not limited to, I guess I'd ask this within the Housing Choice Voucher program. I would love to know about evictions and how that looks over time, just eviction rates of people with vouchers. I assume they do get evicted because of other lease noncompliance.
We can provide you that information.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what those rates look like, and I would love to know that too. And that relates to something else I've been curious about, which is, can you talk to me a little more, because this is something, if we're thinking about like constituent issues that we get, you guys can all tell me if it's just me, but I doubt it. We'll hear from people that have a voucher and that are having a landlord issue. And so I don't have a great understanding of what DHA requires of landlords, since this is choice, this is the, you know, the market, people are going out and finding their own housing. Can you talk to me a little bit about that? Like, I'll tell you, I don't even know on the most basic level, is the lease agreement just between the tenant and the landlord like it usually would be? You're not a party to that. Do you insist on certain terms in that lease, or are you just providing the voucher and nothing else? You know, those kind of things.
Yeah, so you're on the right path in your understanding in that we like to describe it, and HUD also describes it as a triangle relationship, in that there is the relationship with the housing provider, which aka landlord, and the participant, and that's the lease agreement. that ties the two of them together. The housing authority and the housing provider has a HAP contract, which ties us to the housing provider. And then there's HUD that provides the funding to the housing authority to, you know, provide the subsidy to the housing, to we HUD provides us with the subsidy to pay the housing provider the subsidy, and then the tenant pays their portion of the rent to directly to the landlord. Okay. To talk, you asked about what do we require as far as the housing provider and the lease agreement. We ask that the lease agreement mirrors the lease agreement that it would for any non-HCB participant,
right,
so that that lease agreement is fair and utilized across the board, and that there's nothing outside, of course, the laws that is in that agreement. So, for example, they cannot say to a housing voucher participant, hey, you have some of your subsidy paid, so I want more deposit from you than I would require from another person. Mm-hmm. Things like that. Those general basic things is what we're looking at.
Okay. And are you involved at all if there are sort of disputes or like warrant of habitability type issues between a tenant or a landlord in the Choice program or not? I mean,
if,
I'm sure
if
you
we're
get called.
Made, right, yes, right. If we're made aware of them, so generally speaking, if a landlord or tenant is having issues with the housing provider and say that it's a lease violation or something with the unit, then we will intervene. The tenant has the ability to request what we call complaint inspections, emergency inspections, if something is going wrong with the unit, because then we'll send an inspector out. And if we find that, yeah, there's a violation, the housing provider is required to make those repairs, or we're issue a voucher to the tenant to find another unit that's safe, decent, or sanitary.
Okay.
We do have conferences that we will offer in cases of obligations, rules, or that type of thing, to just kind of make sure that the family understand their obligations under the program and what their responsibilities are.
Okay, thank you. That's actually, even the terminology is so helpful to know. All right, and then I have some questions also around utilization rates, and so this may be getting a little more into the project-based neck of the woods, but I'm curious where those are at, and if you could talk to me about any like utilization bottlenecks.
Utilization bottlenecks when it comes to project-based vouchers. Our utilization rate right now is about 82%. Mm-hmm. We are allowed to project-base 30% of our vouchers under the project-based program. And of that, when I say 82% utilization, some of the units that we're currently project basing are exempt from that cap, so that gives us a little bit of flexibility on that. Bottlenecks as to the project-based leasing right now is probably the most successful leasing that we have, because the subsidy is tied to the unit itself.
Right.
So when a family is accepted into a project-based unit, the subsidy is coming with them.
It's kind of seamless. Yeah. Okay. I'm curious also, sort of related to that, I have heard that a few providers on the project-based side have the sense that, or I guess are experiencing that they thought that they would get a certain number of vouchers that was contracted for and that was reduced. Is that even ringing a bell? Do you know what I mean with that? And can you explain what happened there? Yeah. I mean, I'm
yes.
guessing I might know what happened, but you can tell us.
Yes.
Is it the feds?
No. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so with that, we are managing compliance of the project base as well, right? Right now, we're looking for every opportunity to tighten up and streamline the program that's available. And so if a housing provider, for example, entered into the program at year 5 with 100 units, but they're only leasing 50, and they've not leased those 50 within the 120-day requirements, those units are removed because they've been remained vacant and now considered out of compliance.
Okay.
And so some housing providers may say, wait, I've lost units. No, you were out of compliance.
Okay. Thank you. I had a feeling it was parallel. It's basically parallel to what's happening with families, right? So, okay. I know I had one other area of questions, so thank you for the time. I'm going to see, because I think...
You asked questions that I didn't know I wanted to know answers to, so thank you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I wanted to go back to the questions that Councilmember Torres was asking also and just make sure I'm understanding this. And I think I'll just say for myself, I don't know that I don't have much understanding of these vouchers that DHA had agreed to allocate to the city. So I'll just say I don't know much about that. You might have thought that any given council member did. I at least did not, or I forgot. So you were saying it was an agreement to allocate 100 vouchers per year to the city for each of 3 years, 24, 25, 26 was supposed to be. Is that right? And can you explain, this is again so base level, but can you explain a little bit more what it was meant by allocating them to the city? Like how they were to be used, I guess.
So basically providing an allocation on increments of 100 per year to the city. So the city will be acting for all intent and purposes after referral for those 100 opportunities. And in that process, DHA issue those vouchers to those possible after determining eligibility requirements and all of those things, you know, we then issue the applicable quote unquote voucher to those participants so they can become part of the program. So
and
basically,
were they participants who were in city contracted shelter or could, like, if, I know this is more of a city side question, but who was your understanding of the folks to be served by those exactly?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so these are referrals, again, access to refer individuals to the vouchers, making it clear that these are not individuals that were attached to the voucher and then removed. That was my understanding, at that these vouchers were going to be allocated to folks entering, exiting a shelter of some type.
Okay, I gotcha. And this is also a silly question, but how's that possible given wait lists? Because I have always had a vague understanding that there's just deep wait lists for vouchers. So, yeah, and I guess that's another question.
Right.
Wait lists. How big are they? What's the deal with those?
That is the power of the special programs, because when you define special programs that are attached to specific populations facing some additional considerations, right?
Homelessness
in this case. Then you have a direct pool, if you will, that is going to be leveraged for the purpose of providing those housing stability opportunities instead of the individuals going through the conventional lottery process that we have in place.
Okay, thank you. This is, again, we're just filling knowledge gaps, but it's really helpful. And then can you take one more step back then and explain a little bit more to me about the, more of the details of the special program funding itself, where that came from, and I take it it's drying up, but.
It's the same budget authority in the end. I mean, for example, the Veteran Affairs program is aimed to provide housing and supports to veterans, right? As the program itself implies. That is within the larger budget authority that is provided to any given housing authority, the DHA included, but with the specific purpose of this program, which is called Veteran Affairs. Same with non-elderly, Foster Youth Initiative is one additional special program. The Family Unification Program is one more that we have. So those are specific programs with specific purposes outside of the fact of providing housing stability. I mean, the main pool of tenant-based vouchers, the purpose is to provide housing stability. No more, no less than that is housing stability. Now we have some additional programs that are aiming to achieve just that, plus this specific circumstance that this program is aiming to address, right?
Okay, and how does that work for your housing authority's budget then, understanding, I get what you're saying, that they're more targeted and you have more flexibility, but can you explain to me, like for a given year, at what point do you know how much you'll be able to spend on those special projects? How is it different than your overall HCV budget that's much more numeric, I guess?
So we receive a budget authority of X amount of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And then it comes to disbursements that we are receiving based on a number of factors, including the actual utilization of the resources, a look back period, meaning 2-3 months in the past, and how above the baseline or below are we? So then based on that, HUD is providing to us the disbursements that are going to cover a number of months of consideration, and in the end, those plus and minuses will need to be in or reconcile with that level of authority that we are getting from HUD to manage the programs. Okay. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, and it's related to the comparative funding chart that you put up, which was also really, really helpful. And I'm sort of staring at this. You have these different categories of federal funding that you get, right? So obviously, housing choice voucher renewals.
If I may speak a little bit more about that. On that schedule, you see many, many categories, including the presidential budget initially, the most recent House version and the Senate version, but also a column I think is in the middle that speaks about the housing industry or an industry request. What that means is that our ecosystem of partners through the advocacy groups, in this case, the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, the Council of Large Public Housing Authorities, the Public Housing Authorities Directors Association, we have come together to say, we hear you, but this is what we need to serve our different communities in the best way possible, considering.
So that's the real budget. What is it?
Considering the circumstances. The reality is that most likely we are going to, we may get less than that in most, not to say all of the programs. Hopefully, in the end, that is not going to be the case. But I mean, that right there, even though that is the industry request, that is not a directly proportional relation that will say that every single community across the board is going to be funded at the levels that they deserve. You are going to have some jurisdictions that are going to be well-funded, while others will continue having some struggles based on the affordability issues and many things like that that are, you know, underlying considerations to that equation there.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And when will you know? I should know this because I should know when the federal budget happens, but I don't. When do you think you'll have a better sense of where this lands?
That is the question that everybody is asking.
Shut down.
Yeah. So right now, the most recent information that I have is that, you know, there is not a there is work, of course, being done, and most relevant to us, you know, through those same advocacy groups and directly by the different housing authorities, but there is no timeline set to say, well, this is going to last one more week or whatever.
Yeah.
So what we are all hoping is that as soon as possible, before the end of the month of October, to say November.
When the shutdown ends, the budget comes out, you guys will basically know at that point.
Historically, the largest one has been for 35 days.
Yeah.
So this one is...
Let me ask this kind of a better way, I guess. Once the federal budget is set, is it sort of automatic then what Denver's share of that is, or are there later steps to that?
It depends. Some programs are through formula, some others are within other considerations.
But you'll have a pretty good sense once this number is set of like how that looks for Denver. Okay.
Yeah, definitely we will know. And we will be happy to report as soon as we get.
Yeah, we would be interested in seeing it. And then how are there any other ways that the shutdown is impacting you all other than just, you know, waiting for information? Like what's happening with your disbursements and everything else?
Yeah, I think right now we're business as usual. We have some healthy reserves. We've been doing an analysis to figure out, you know, the longer this goes on, what that means for us. We're actively contingency planning for that, for the worst case scenario, because that's the responsible thing that we need to do, right? We're hoping that we don't end up there. Right now, as of today, the impacts on us are relatively minor. As it drags on, obviously, then we have to start looking at what that looks like when checks need to be going out and checks aren't coming in.
Okay, but basically, thanks to your reserves, you've got some time on that. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Okay. I won't ask you to say anything you don't want to say publicly, but certainly reach out to us if we're approaching anything that might start to get concerning, I would say. Okay.
And if I could just add one piece specific to the Housing Choice Voucher Program. Our housing providers cannot evict a participant if the housing authority fails to make a HAP payment.
Okay.
As long as the participant pays their portion of the rent,
that remedies against you.
That the housing provider has to wait, just like we would have to wait if we don't have HAP payments to be made. But that does provide some level of safety for our participants.
Okay, that's really good. Thank you for telling me that. Does anyone else, other members, have any questions that have occurred in all of that? Just a sort of wide-ranging, but this is, again, I wanted to bring this presentation to this committee just because we hear about vouchers kind of as a side item when we're talking to hosts about how we fund all kinds of, you know, housing-related stuff. We hear about it from people who are working on amazing projects, and then we hear from renters sometimes, you know, tenants. And so it just it's nice to have a little better understanding of all these structures. You have something?
I don't really – thank you, Madam Chair. I don't really have a question. I think it's more just of a comment. And I think throughout this entire conversation with your – questions with both of your questions that have been asked, I think it just further elevates or shows the complexity of these support systems that help keep families afloat. And right now, you might have someone that, you know, if one clip, I don't want to call it the clip effect, but it's a little bit of an effect. If one thing falls off, then it affects your other one, whether it be your housing, your food, your child care, and how delicately balanced it is. So when it works, it works and families are staying afloat. But at the same time, when you have so much unpredictability at a federal level, that's really determining what's happening to families here on the ground. I just appreciate the work that you're doing to make sure that families still are receiving the services and the housing that they so desperately need. And knowing that in this particular time with that uncertainty, that you're just keeping your eye on the ball for being able to respond. So I just wanted to say thank you for the work that you're doing, because it is... it's a lot of unknowns and a lot of gray right now. So I think so much of your comments have been, or so much of this presentation and the comments have been so timely with things that we need to be thinking about.
That's a really, thank you, Pro Tem, for going to a more human place with this, because I know from honestly, I want to compliment your folks, because I've had a few troubleshooting kinds of situations with people that have reached out to my office with the shorter times to secure units. And I could tell that there were people at DHE that were just like moving heaven and earth to try to get folks into a unit. Yeah. And that there's no way that this added workload is not really hitting your folks, because they're the same staff that you had, right? And so I'm just appreciative of that. And those are all our constituents. And so we're here if we can ever help. We're here if we can ever help even with communication and things like that. We can't help with the federal government, but we're here to help your constituents too. So don't hesitate if we can ever support people. We're not that closely. You all, I think, talk and work a lot with host on a policy level. City Council, you know, you're not funded by us. We're not in charge of you. And so we come and ask you questions, and you're great and lovely, and we're grateful for what you do. But we're sort of two, you know, independent things sitting next to each other. And I think I just would love to get the message back to everyone who works there that our appreciation, that we know how difficult it must be right now. And we always have appreciated everyone at DHA, but in particular right now.
So if I may, as a final point and relevant to that, I wanted to let you know, and I think it's very important to say that most recently, and this is the second time that we have been doing this ever since last year, we had what we call our housing symposium with housing providers. Mm-hmm. And what I want to highlight is just the fact that DHA, and following, you know, George's and Loretta's leadership specifically, we have maintained, even within the environment in which we are, a direct level of communication and interaction making sure that there are no gaps within that level of communication that should exist. Yes, we remain open to feedback, and we want to improve on that sense, right? But I think it's very important to let you know that from the constituency standpoint, we are maintaining that level of communication with those that are serving our families and individuals across the board. And we have remained always open to those dialogues on a proactive way, but also maintaining DHA as a listening ear for whatever may be any necessary piece of feedback, right? And we truly appreciate that at all times. Just wanted to say that because it's important to recognize, you know, Renata's leadership on that standpoint, maintaining that level of communication that is important.
Thanks. Well, if there are no other questions, then I think we can adjourn. We have no items on consent, and we just deeply appreciate your time, especially
thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you.